Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the Richmond school shooting. Franciscan Health is opening a first-of-its-kind HIV and hepatitis B clinic in Hammond. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Northwest Indiana advocate Marcus Martin about homelessness in the region. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. A middle school in Indiana was the site for another school shooting Thursday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay and Lauren Chapman reports the shooter has died, but no students at the Richmond school were injured.
Richmond Community Schools tweeted early Thursday saying Dennis Intermediate School was experiencing an active shooter situation. Indiana State Police say they received an early morning tip about a possible violent act at the school. Spokesperson Sergeant John Bowling says the 14-year-old shooter died after exchanging gunfire with police inside the school.
The preliminary investigation shows that the teen shooter unfortunately chose to take his own life.
Both the school district and police say no other students were harmed and the investigation is ongoing. A 13-year-old opened fire in a Noblesville school earlier this year, injuring a classmate and teacher. That situation sparked additional funding and school safety measures at the State House. Lawmakers have said it's a top priority in 2019. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. State officials say an HIV and hepatitis C clinic opening in Hammond is the first of its kind. Franciscan Health announced the multi-specialty clinic this month with a blessing and open house. The clinic will be open Wednesdays from 8 a.m. to noon and will offer services that include screenings and connections to care and support. Jolita Holloman is Hepatitis C Program Director for Franciscan Health. She says the clinic will provide a variety of services, including assistance for those seeking prescriptions and counseling for medication needs.
Bringing together not only providers and access to linkage to care and treatment opportunities, but also bringing in pharmacy.
She says that's part of what makes the clinic unique. A grant from Gilead Sciences, the Frontlines of Communities in the United States, or FOCUS, will fund the clinic. Holloman says anyone born between 1945 and 1965 has the highest risk for contracting hepatitis C. But, she says, intravenous drug use and needle sharing can also contribute to the spread of the virus. The clinic will open December 19th and will serve Northwest Indiana and the southern suburbs of Chicago.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Milford P. Christensen, founder of Christensen Chevrolet, died Monday at the age of 96. Rick Reifa, president of the Griffith Town Council, said he confirmed Christensen's passing with White Funeral Home in Griffith. A 2015 Times profile of Christensen reported that into his 90s, he went to work daily at the dealership he opened in 1951. As a child growing up in Griffith, he worked for family businesses, which included a hardware store, a furniture store, and a construction firm. He enrolled at Indiana University in Bloomington in the fall of 1940. Christensen recalled, quote, "My final semester, I was drafted into the U.S. Army. I served 3.5 years in the 87th Infantry as a radio and communications man. In July 1944, he began his military service in Europe, escaping death 3 times as his unit fought during the Battle of the Bulge during December 1944 and January 1945. He completed his bachelor's degree in business administration at IU Bloomington following his discharge. Christensen was a member of IU's Alumni Association and was a member of its varsity club board. His dealership supplied the university's athletic department with an automobile annually. After graduating from IU, he returned to Griffith and took a prominent role in the family businesses. In 1951, he and his family bought a local Chevrolet dealership and ran it in downtown Griffith until 1963. The dealership grew, and the Chevrolet Motor Division required the business to relocate to larger quarters. In 2001, Christensen Chevrolet was named Indiana Dealer of the Year by Time magazine. In 2012, he was inducted into the Northwest Indiana Business and Industry Memory Hall of Fame. For 25 years, he served on the volunteer Griffith Fire Department and was a Griffith School Board member from 1965 to 1980. He was a member of the Griffith Rotary Club, which in 2015, he had a record for perfect attendance for more than 47 years and attended Rotary Club meetings in 46 countries around the world. He was known for his generosity. Christensen said in a 2012 interview with The Times around the time he was set to be inducted into the Northwest Indiana Business and Industry Hall of Fame, quote, "I give away about $50,000 to $100,000 a year." He was married to Margaret, and the couple had two children.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A judge has rejected a special prosecutor in a September shooting that wounded a man and his 9-year-old son outside a store. Alex C. Hughes faces attempted murder and criminal gang activity charges for allegedly shooting the 25-year-old man and his son outside a Walmart store in Hobart. His defense attorney filed a motion in November seeking a special prosecutor to represent the state after he learned that Lake County Prosecutor Bernard A. Carter's sister and brother-in-law were present during the September 30th shooting at the store. But the Times reports that a Lake County judge rejected that special prosecutor request Tuesday. The judge said he didn't believe that the presence of Carter's sister and brother-in-law created a conflict of interest for the prosecutor's office.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Authorities have charged a Northwest Indiana woman in the bludgeoning death of her infant daughter. The Times reports 25-year-old Lisa Marie Rodriguez of Hammond appeared in court Friday, a day after being arrested. She was charged with murder and other crimes in connection with the death Tuesday of 4-month-old Brooklyn Rodriguez. Rodriguez requested an attorney and said she had no income or property. Brooklyn's death was ruled a homicide by blunt force trauma to the head. A pathologist also found bruises on the girl's torso. Brooklyn's father, Nicholas Bray, faces criminal charges. He's accused of twice attacking Lisa Marie while she was pregnant, though his attorney says Bray was defending himself.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The U.S. Department of Transportation is set to send Indiana $40 million to add additional lanes to parts of both northbound and southbound I-65. The money comes from the Better Utilizing Investments to Leverage Development, or BUILD, program. Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao says the money goes to projects targeting several different issues.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
An Indiana judge has entered a preliminary not guilty plea for a high school football player accused of killing a 17-year-old schoolmate who was pregnant with his child. The St. Joseph County judge also denied bail Tuesday for 16-year-old Aaron Trejo, who's charged as an adult with murder and feticide. He appeared at the hearing via a video feed. Trejo's family plans to hire a private attorney. Prosecutors say he told officers he fatally stabbed Brianna Rosalang because he was angry she waited so long to tell him she was pregnant and that it was too late to get an abortion. Her body was found in a dumpster in their hometown of Mishawaka. Trejo is a Mishawaka high school football player and Rosalang was a team manager. Relatives say she was 6 months pregnant.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb says he wants to raise teacher salaries in the long and the short term. Last week, Holcomb drew criticism after saying he may delay the issue until 2021.
We've got to identify hundreds of millions of dollars and the means to get it into teacher paychecks.
Holcomb says this will take years. In the short term, he suggests more general K-12 funding that schools have the option to use to increase teacher pay. Last week, Education Groups, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jennifer McCormick, and the Indiana State Teachers Association criticized Holcomb for directing lawmakers away from immediate action. ISTA President Teresa Meredith says Indiana teacher salaries are not competitive and teachers are leaving the states and the profession.
We've heard that legislators and the governor are ready to do something. And then we've heard they weren't. But this issue can't wait. We expect action in 2019.
HOCM's guidance last week was to research the situation and take action in the 2021 budget session.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
There's been a debate over whether a proposed confined animal feeding operation would pollute drinking water in Newton County. But now an expert is weighing in. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, a retired hydrologist says placing a CAFO in that area would increase the risk of well contamination.
Natural Prairie Dairy wants to raise more than 4,000 grass-fed cows in a dried-up lake bed on the edge of a former marsh. Martin Risch, a hydrologist recently retired from the U.S. Geological Survey, completed a technical review at the request of the Hoosier Environmental Council. He says spreading that much waste on an area prone to being wet is a bad idea. He compares the situation to a tightrope walker with a pan of water balanced on their head.
The tightrope walker is already in a precarious position, and they're wobbling back and forth, and some of that water from that pan is going to slop out.
Natural Prairie Dairy declined to comment on Risch's report, but did say it trusts the state will do a rigorous review of its application. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Department of Children's Services says it needs about $300 million more per year in funding than it got in the last state budget. When Indiana lawmakers passed a two-year budget in 2017, they gave DCS more than $600 million a year, but the number of children in the system then dramatically increased. Legislators and the governor responded, sending hundreds of millions more to the agency in one-time money. Now, DCS says it needs that one-time money to become part of its ongoing budget. It wants $965 million a year the next 2 years. Republican Senator Liz Brown points out DCS's request doesn't account for any new increase of children who need services.
My concern is that the mode of operation, if you will stay the same.
But DCS Director Terry Stigden says the agency changed its strategies. For instance, it doesn't immediately remove children from their homes as much.
So if you look at our caseloads, they're going down.
Lawmakers will pass a new state budget in April.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Elkhart's Police Merit Commission officially promoted two detectives, a police officer who has a DUI conviction in Noblesville, Indiana, from last spring. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jennifer Weingart has more.
Officer Brandon Roundtree was pulled over and blew a .083, just over the legal limit to drive, in Noblesville in March of 2017. He pleaded guilty in August and was given a 60-day license suspension, 60 days in jail, which was suspended, and a year's probation. He remained on the police force in Elkhart during that time and was not disciplined by the department. He was officially promoted to detective by the Police Merit Commission on Monday, 6 months after being promoted to the position by Chief Edwin Bigler. Acting Police Chief Todd Thayer says the discrepancy in the promotion dates was a mistake.
It was an error. It was something that fell through the cracks. That's all it was. It didn't get to him. We recognized our error and we corrected it. In no way was it a cover-up.
The South Bend Tribune reports Roundtree's promotion was first brought before the board in May 2017. Board President James Rickoff.
As I recall, the commission approved his promotion, but before it took effect, the department asked that it be pulled back, pending resolution of these other things.
Thayer repeated a claim also made by Wynn Bigler that the DUI was not done how we would do it.
We questioned the whole process down there of how that arrest took place. We wouldn't have handled it that way in our community for a DUI.
Thayer declined to clarify why he believed the DUI was questionable. The Elkhart Police Department is under increased scrutiny after a series of South Bend Tribune and ProPublica investigations uncovered issues in the department's disciplinary practices. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jennifer Weingart.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A male student is suing Indiana University, saying the school violated Title IX by suspending him after a rape investigation. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Costello reports, it's the latest in a series of lawsuits invoking the federal civil rights law on behalf of men accused of sexual assault.
A female student referred to as Jane Doe in the lawsuit accused the man, John Doe, of rape and exploitation. The school got a report in September 2017 that someone took a photo of them having sex at a fraternity house and shared it with others. IU investigated the incident within a few days. But in May 2018, the school launched a new investigation after Jane reported she was too drunk to give consent that night and accused John of sexual assault. The Monroe County Prosecutor's Office declined to file charges, but an IU panel determined John, quote, more likely than not, violated code of conduct policies about sexual consent and allowed that photo to be taken. His punishment included a 4-year suspension. John's lawsuit says the IU investigation was unbalanced, showing a gender bias that violates Title IX. He wants to return to IU immediately and is asking for a trial to determine monetary damages. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Becca Costello.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
After a few years of farmers struggling to make a profit and the addition of tariff uncertainty to the economic mix, some farmers have begun looking for new markets to tap. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, one expert says some farmers may be able to find success in producing products targeted to a younger generation.
All hands in a crowded room of farmers at the Indiana Farm Bureau State Convention stayed down over the weekend when the group was asked how many attendees expected to be better off this year than last year. Purdue University College of Agriculture Associate Dean Jason Henderson advised the assembly to look to the future, saying millennials are making different purchasing choices than previous generations.
They purchase agricultural products in various different ways. You think about local foods, food for health, organics.
He says what once may have been niche products could allow farmers to capture more money than traditional crops in the future.
It's a different business model, a different financial model, a different marketing model. And if agriculture can figure out how to sell into that market and tailor individual products, they'll get higher value and potentially some opportunities.
Henderson says this doesn't mean farmers should stop producing soybeans or corn, but should try to find ways to be more flexible. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A farm bill compromise announced this week includes removing hemp from a list of banned substances and making it a regular agricultural crop. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, changing the plant's classification might ease some Indiana legislators' concerns.
Previous attempts have been made to legalize hemp production in Indiana, but have failed in the Senate thanks to concerns about the plant's relationship to marijuana. Indiana Farm Bureau State Government Relations Director Justin Snyder predicts the language in the federal farm bill might be the change that finally gets such a bill to the governor's desk in 2019.
I think that's the thing that really is needed to put everyone at ease at the state level.
Indiana farmer Mike Boyer was able to grow hemp on his farm through a research permit this past season. He dismisses the argument farmers would stop growing other crops if they could grow hemp.
This is not going to be a commodity crop replacement. This is simply will be something that will add diversity and another crop to our rotation here within our own state.
A study committee this summer examined the issue in hopes of crafting legislation for the session, which begins next month. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The U.S. Department of Transportation is set to send Indiana $40 million to add additional lanes to parts of both northbound and southbound I-65. The money comes from the Better Utilizing Investments to Leverage Development, or BUILD, program. Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao says the money goes to projects targeting several different issues.
The BUILD program supports infrastructure improvements that advance the goals of safety, improve the quality of life, environmental protection, state of good repair, economic competitiveness, and innovation.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A proposed change to the controversial Waters of the United States rule could reduce the number of waters in Indiana regulated by the federal government. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, the Environmental Protection Agency announced the possible change Tuesday.
The proposed rule would exclude certain wetlands and ditches, as well as streams that only flow during rain events, from federal regulations. Indra Frank serves as the Director of Water Policy for the Hoosier Environmental Council.
What the EPA's proposal does is fail to acknowledge the fact that all of our waters are interconnected.
Frank says pollution from a small body of water can drain into larger rivers and lakes, or even drinking water supplies. While the 2015 WOTUS rule is in effect in 22 states, it's been blocked from being implemented in 28 others, including Indiana. EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler says the proposed change would provide consistency in the law and more clarity for landowners. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The total out-of-pocket cost for Hoosiers with employer-based health insurance has doubled in the past decade. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports a new analysis focuses on policies that could help improve affordability.
More than half the people in Indiana receive health insurance through their employers, and the cost continues to rise. Hoosiers spend about 6% of their median income on insurance with an average $1,800 deductible. Sarah Collins with the Commonwealth Fund says middle-income people feel the pinch most.
So we're just finding that the rate of growth in what people are spending or contributing to their premiums is climbing faster than growth in median income.
Premium costs rose more than 13% in just 1 year between 2016 and 17. The report says Congress could take action by providing more tax credits and covering more services. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Football is one of the most dangerous sports, but it's not just contact between players that results in them getting hurt. It's also contact with the field itself. NFL teams are required to follow certain field guidelines, all in an effort to offer athletes a high-quality, safe place to play. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright reports, one collegiate team in Indiana is following suit.
It's about 2 a.m. at Lucas Oil Stadium, where the Indianapolis Colts play. But the field is bustling with activity. Workers are preparing for the Colts to play at 1, and it's a lot of work. Some people are assembling goalposts, others are using brooms to sweep up debris. And a couple folks are driving machines across the field. The field is made up of artificial grass fibers that sit on top of layers of sand and rubber. The machines running across it are very important. They comb through the crumb rubber and evenly disperse it. Troy Glendening is the director of facilities and grounds for the Colts. He says the goal is to make sure the field isn't too hard, but that it's also not too soft.
Basically evening it out, because the rubber and the sand kind of get displaced and then brought to the surface. So that just kind of like a drag, and it just evens everything out.
The NFL requires teams test fields for hardness up to 72 hours before each home game. They use what's called a Clegg impact tester. It sits about 2 feet off the ground and drops a weight onto the field, then provides a reading. They repeat the Clegg test in multiple spots on the field.
It could be really good somewhere, and then where there's a lot of traffic, say golf carts and stuff coming in and out, now it could be too hard.
The Clegg test has to measure within a certain range. After testing, Glendening does a visual inspection of the field, and if he thinks it looks good, he signs off on it. That's what happens today.
Okay. I'm happy.
Glendening says NFL teams have been testing their fields like this for a long time, but the league started to pay more attention to the testing within the last few years. All the prep work ensures athletes are playing on a level field and are less likely to get an injury, like a concussion. It's the reason Indiana University's sports turf management crew is following the NFL's lead. Jeremy Treadway is the sports turf manager for IU. He says the NCAA doesn't require the testing like at the professional level.
I was actually at a Big Ten facilities meeting a few years back and overheard another Big Ten university talking about how they Clegg test their their field before every game to be proactive. And, you know, I thought it would be nice on our end to start implementing that.
Before, they only tested Memorial Stadium's field a couple times a year. This year, the group started testing the day before each game. One of the crew members walks to different spots across the field and drops the weight from the Clegg test. He wants to get a reading under 200.
Not bad, 89.
Treadway says the stadium's field typically tests pretty well, but if it didn't, just like the Colts crew, they have ways to fix it. They fire up the machine that rakes through the field, smoothing it out. Treadway says the number one reason for testing more often is to make the field safer for players. He says he anticipates the testing requirements will eventually trickle down from the NFL to the collegiate level. And Glendinning agrees.
And it should probably trickle down even farther than that, you know, because a lot of these high schools now are getting these fields and they're not maintained properly.
The numerous hours spent preparing the field may go unrecognized by the fans who pack into the stadium seats simply hoping for an exciting game. But the game couldn't really happen without the folks behind the scenes, and they're often going above and beyond to make sure your favorite running back or wide receiver doesn't end up on the sidelines. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Northwest Indiana advocate Marcus Martin.
In East Chicago, there is an activist who has found what some may consider a very unique way to show his support and in turn hope to make some change with the problem of homelessness here in Northwest Indiana. And with this, to tell us more about it and more about a very interesting church called Grace Beyond Borders is Marcus Martin. Marcus, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me here, and I appreciate this opportunity to share just some of the things that's going on in Northwest Indiana that a lot of people are not aware of.
Well, take a moment, if you will, first just briefly describe what Grace Beyond Borders Northwest Indiana is all about.
Yes, we're a nonprofit, a 501c nonprofit organization, and we had our this initiation in 2013, in which we began to, for over these last 6 years, rescue homeless women, children, and men out of deplorable, unsafe, unsanitary conditions by offering them a hand up, not a handout.
How serious is the problem of homelessness here in Northwest Indiana?
Well, from our 6 years of on the streets, see, we spend a lot of time on the streets making connections with homeless individuals and with citizens who are very much aware of what's really going on with homelessness. And we uncovered just huge problem that was being ignored or not, people were not aware of what's really going on by the number of homelessness that we encountered. And just from May till now, it's been a tsunami of homeless women with children who are seeking emergency help, and it's just not there. In East Chicago, there is not any type of emergency shelter or transitional housing for individuals who are homeless.
I know that you have described in one media account that the homeless are our invisible neighbor. And explain, if you will, please, why you feel that way.
Yes, they are neighbors because, one, they're part of our community, and they are often hidden for two reasons. One, people ignore them. They tend not to look or make eye contact with individuals who they deem may be homeless. Or the second thing is a lot of people who are homeless are embarrassed and ashamed of their situation, not ever planning to be homeless. And something happened in their life where unemployment, domestic violence, medical hardship propelled them into homelessness. So because of the embarrassment and shame, they just do not want to be identified as being homeless. oftentimes they're right in our company, and because they don't look homeless, we think they don't exist. So they're invisible.
I know we've heard accounts of even going to young people who are homeless, family members who are homeless, and youngsters going to school, and it seems, at least to everybody around them, particularly at school, that there's nothing wrong, except that there's really is something wrong, that there's that maybe the young person relies on the meals he gets or she gets at school because there is no place at home to be able to have a regular meal, and then staying at home basically means staying in a shelter.
Well, when you are a school-age child, you have the school as a place to not only get a meal but also to wash up, especially if you're in a situation which we have been alerted of, as individuals who are sleeping in their vehicles with their children, adults who don't have any other place to of any type of refuge or shelter. So you have to wash up. You have to maintain your cleanliness, or otherwise you can get teased or bullied. So school could be arriving at school very early, leaving late, opportunities where a person can actually wash up. You got your fast food restaurants. People tend to wash up. They go inside one of the stalls, lock the door, and they're able to change clothes and wash up. See, these things are going on under our nose, and many people just don't pay attention, or we don't care, or we're not concerned. But I have a campaign, A Night Without a Home, for 30 days where I'm going out overnight and sleeping in the various locations where a homeless population is sleeping now, or they have slept. These are locations they have revealed to us, mm-hmm. through Grace Beyond Borders.
So, what places have you been able to spend overnights in?
Wow. Some of the tough ones, under a bridge, mm-hmm. A few yards from the railroad tracks, on a picnic table at a popular park, on the seating area of a picnic table in another park, an abandoned house. I should say a vacant house, because it was owned by individual I knew. In another a vacant property, and also in my vehicle. And one of the creative ways, a college student, a mom, whose husband had his hands around her neck trying to choke her to death in front of her four-year-old, so she chose to be homeless to escape that situation and could not find any shelter. So she got her daughter into a safe place, and she had her personal vehicle, so she would park at night in the garage of one of the local hospitals where there's lighting and a sense of safety there. And that's the kind of, you have to be creative. You have to sleep somewhere at night, and it can be very uncomfortable being on the streets exposed to whatever situations may be out there.
I know there's one example that you give about these places where I guess what you could say the not so hidden homeless are staying in abandoned buildings. They're not vacant because it's where a lot of homeless people stay. You describe us what one of these homes that has been occupied on Elm Street looks like. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a two-story house, and some homeless individuals were able to gain access to the house through the window of the basement, or through the back window near the porch area. And so you figure they are out of the elements, and they had a number of different rooms there. It was, I believe, a two-bedroom house, downstairs and upstairs. Mm-hmm. So you had a number of people can stay in there. Then you had the bedrooms had doors, so you can have a number of individuals, even couples, who are staying in that type of setting. And these are individuals that pretty much know each other, and from time to time, they are able to gather together and say, hey, we have a place here. There's no light. There isn't any light at night, and there's not any running water or heat, so there's no utilities, but it's a place where they can lie down at night. close their eyes because there's simply not anything else available. And we want to turn that around, and that's what our campaign is doing now, to reach the individuals who have a heart, who, if they know about this situation, will not allow individuals to sleep in those type of settings, that would respond and give a small donation. Just skip a meal, one meal out the month, and just one meal, which could be a $5, you know, fast food or restaurant meal, and donate that to Grace Beyond Border.
We're talking with Marcus Martin, executive director and founder of an organization called Grace Beyond Borders. They're located in East Chicago. And I understand this is really a kind of an outgrowth of what you had done as a volunteer for a church in Chicago, the Apostolic Church of God. They've been very involved, I guess, on volunteer level for some time with the homeless, and certainly in the Chicago area. And you find it's the same problem everywhere, apparently.
Yes. You know, it was a real eye-opener for me when I started back in 2001 with our homeless outreach ministry in Chicago. I mean, it's a good example. See people on the streets but not realizing how many people are actually homeless unless you're at a homeless shelter there. And then you see the number of people going in there. I just had no idea. And then when I looked at Indiana, it's different. You're not seeing people who are camped out, you know, in certain areas. You don't see tents and you don't see mattresses and things. But we had to, as we worked over the last 6 years, we began to ask a question, where are you sleeping? And that's when we started identifying the different multiple locations individuals have slept.
Do you find in talking with folks, regardless whether it's in Chicago or here in Northwest Indiana, that with the problem of homelessness being so pervasive all over, not only our region, but all over the country, that the efforts to help support these people are pretty much the same, that if you're offering hope and love and care as well for all these folks and for food and clothing and lodging for those that need it the most, that it seems to give them hope and in turn will maybe possibly help turn some of their lives around?
Well, let me give you an example. Back in 2015, I met a woman during my outreach on the streets, which we did a lot of. That's where the contact is made, on the streets. And this young woman would participate in what we call our Celebrate Recovery program. And she had a heroin addiction and also was in an abusive relationship. And off and on, she would come and, you know, be involved with our program, and we just poured the love of God all over her, and then she disappeared. But back in September, she came in, and she had hit bottom. She said she was tired, and she knew what she needed to do, and we encouraged her, and she is doing this super great right now. She just finished up a 60-day initial recovery program, treatment program in South Bend, where we assisted her with transportation to get there. And then also she is enrolled in a long-term recovery program. And that's critical.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it takes. And she is just so determined, and she communicates with me every week, and, you know, two or three times out the week. She's all over my Facebook page. With words of encouragement, but that's an example. When you give a person an opportunity and you open up the door and you deal with a total person, mind, body, spirit, then you give them a chance, you give them hope to move out of their situation, because that woman also had a story of this adverse childhood experience,
mm-hmm.
of rape during her, you know, by a relative,
right.
So and abuse. You know, constant. So rising over all that requires not just a place for them to lay their head down, to lie down, but a place where they can begin to heal. They can, you know, things in their lives can be restored, and they can actually get hope to move to the next level, and that's what we do.
It's interesting that you should mention about helping find places for homeless people to stay on a long-term basis, in particular the fact that you're even arranging transportation. Are you finding that the opportunities for homeless shelter options don't happen to be around our area, that you do sometimes have to take somebody to a faraway city to be able to get them to stay in someplace comfortable and more secure?
Most definitely. You have to have places have to have that type of staffing and type of service available. We deal mainly with my mentors, which is the rescue mission in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Also, we've had success with Wheeler Rescue Mission in Indianapolis, and on the Illinois side, Aurora Wayside Mission, because they all offer long-term, and that's critical. It takes time for people to heal and to be restored from just some of the traumas in their lives. They just can't get a quick 8-week fix and put back out on the streets and say, okay, we gave you 8 weeks, next. It has to be where they have some time and which they can grow, which they can, you know, overcome some of the hardships in their life that weren't supposed to be there.
I know that last year that you had an effort going where you were trying to raise some money to be able to purchase property in East Chicago, be able to turn it into an emergency homeless shelter with the kind of services by the trained staff to actually help people become more self-reliant. But you ran into some difficulties then. Are you finding that the goal is still there? It's just maybe taken a different form with this this 30-day campaign of A Night Without a Home?
Great question. The goal is still there. The property's not still there.
Oh.
But we missed that opportunity. But that's okay. There's other properties we will locate in East Chicago. And we do have significant support. We do have to grow some more support. Again, we're reaching out to 8,000 people, just skipping one restaurant meal each month and donating that $5. And just donate that to what we're doing, and we will have those operational dollars that we need, and we can move on. And so we have if I can say now, we do have a place where they can donate. That would be the www.thefaceofgrace. I can't forget the T-H-E, thefaceofgrace.org, and there's an opportunity to donate there also. They can send their, and we do receive checks and money orders at our Grace Beyond Borders post office box, 927 East Chicago, Indiana, 46312. And one important thing, if they really want to see what we're doing, they can go on Facebook and follow. I do live videos from the different locations that I spend the night. And so they can really see the actual locations mm-hmm. where our homeless individuals, they never even paid attention to or thought that individuals would find this as a refuge from or shelters from the weather conditions, but also safety from whatever, you know, situations they could be encountered on the streets. But, you know, you're sleeping and somebody come along. I mean, people do rob people. In fact, one of our clients decided to sleep at a bus stop shelter
mm-hmm.
and was awakened after midnight with a gun at his head, demanding his wallet. And he's homeless. He didn't have any money. And so they struck him in the head with the gun.
Oh, that's sad to hear.
You know, and he was just trying to... have a place to, you know, he didn't have there's not a shelter, so he just found that as he thought it was okay.
Well, Marcus,
out there.
Marcus, thank you very much for spending some time to talk with us about your campaign that's underway right now, A Night Without a Home, and the efforts that Grace Beyond Borders is doing in East Chicago and all of Northwest Indiana in particular, even branching as far away as South Bend as need be to help find homeless residents a place to stay that they feel safe and warm and comfortable in. And we hope to have a chance to check back and see how the campaign's coming along. We appreciate you spending time, Marcus, to talk with us today about it.
Okay.
Marcus Martin is the executive director of an organization called Grace Beyond Borders. It's based in East Chicago, and they're doing their best to help find homes for homeless people in Northwest Indiana.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.